The Esper city of New Hope, central nexus for the Oversoul, was only 10 miles or so due north of the Parade of the Endless. But the Neumann did everything they could to prevent Emma and her new friend from getting there. First came the gravity sleds, dozens of them, sweeping down from above. Disruptor fire raking Emma's sled from all sides. Emma bucked and weaved, riding the air currents for all they were worth to keep her flight unpredictable. Her sled's force shields flared and coruscated, soaking up the discharging energies, always on the very edge of overloading and collapsing, but somehow still maintaining their integrity. It seemed her passion for upgrading and tinkering was paying off after all. Energy bolts seared all around her, shooting in from every side as she threw the sled back and forth, rising and falling on the gusting winds between the towering buildings. At this speed, the bitterly cold air cut at her like a knife as it buffeted around the edges of the prow force shield. But Emma didn't give a damn. Her blood was running hot, and she was grinning more widely than the ecstatic. This was the first decent workout she'd had since she got here. At last, the enemy had revealed himself, and she was going to make him pay for that foolishness in blood. There was no one who could fly a gravity sled better than her. She'd learned her skills the hard way, fighting air pirates on Rhiannon. A dozen gravity sleds came at her in a wave.
Hang on to the crash, bud!
For a moment, she was flying sideways onto her attackers. Disruptor fire chewing up the face of the building behind her. The Neumann sled swung around to block her path, leaving her nowhere to go. They thought. Emma swung her sled around and dove right into the heart of the burning building. The speed she was traveling now, the flames could hardly touch her, and the force shield soaked up most of the heat. But even so, for a moment, it was like flying through the sun. Emma squeezed her eyes shut and held her breath, and hoped her passenger had enough sense to do the same. She was out of the flames and back into the crisp, cold air again. Her hair felt brittle and singed, all her bare skin tingled painfully, and one shoulder of her cloak had caught fire. She slapped the flames out almost casually. She pulled the sled around, bearing down on her previous attackers from behind. The Neumann really should have invested in proper rear shields, like she did. Emma could have called for assistance on the Paragon Emergency Comm Channel, but she didn't. Partly as a matter of pride, but mostly because she didn't know who she could trust anymore. Joy was right about one thing. Pure humanity had supporters everywhere these days, even among the peacekeepers. Safer by far to get the ecstatic to his sanctuary at New Hope as fast as possible, and hope the Espers were as glad to meet Joy as he seemed to think. Even the Neumann would have more sense than to take on the Oversoul. So she gunned her engine for all it was worth, fired her overheating guns at anything stupid enough to fire at her, and occasionally rammed a slower-moving gravity sled that didn't get out of her way fast enough. She'd taken some hits, her sled's armor looked distinctly buckled and battered in places, but most of her force shields were still up and holding, and she was almost at the city limits. Next stop, New Hope. It occurred to her that if this many people were so desperate to try and stop her, then what the ecstatic knew, or thought he knew, probably was worth protecting, even if she didn't have a damn clue what it might be. She shot past the last of the high towers and out into the open air, and suddenly there were no more gravity sleds. She powered on, leaving the city behind her. It slowly occurred to her that even the usual commercial sky traffic seemed to have chosen other lanes. She was alone in the sky. Emma scowled, immediately suspicious, and checked her sled sensor displays, but nothing was showing anywhere near her. It would seem she'd got away with it. The Neumann had given up the pursuit. But Emma Steele was not only a paragon, but a Mistworlder, with all that rebel planet's native cunning and paranoia, and she knew better than to rely on instruments alone, particularly when every instinct she had was screaming at her. So, when the 50-ton military gravity barge emerged suddenly from out of the clouds right in front of her, she was ready for it. There was no doubt the barge was military, even though someone had gone to great trouble to shut down all its markings and insignia. Either it had been hijacked by Neumann, or it was crewed by pure humanity supporters from within the military. Either way, it was big and brutal, and coming straight at her fast. The whole huge shape of it was protected by overlapping force shields, and it was packed with rows of disruptor cannon, already moving to target her. Emma dove for the ground immediately, practically sticking her sled on its nose. Joy hugged her around the waist with both arms, and she led him. She scowled fiercely, running strategies quickly through her mind. She hadn't anticipated a bloody gravity barge. Big bastards and powerful, far superior shields and firepower to anything she had. But barges were notoriously slow and hard to maneuver compared to a sled. She couldn't outrun it or hope to evade its targeting computers for long, but maybe, just maybe, she could outthink the people running it. A ship's only ever as good as its crew. The beam was worryingly close. She pulled out of her dive, pulling back on the yoke so hard the engine screamed in protest. Emma ignored it, roaring towards the open horizon, sacrificing some speed to her dodging and ducking, barely a dozen feet above the ground now. People traveling on the roads below looked up with startled faces. Emma felt like waving, but didn't. She had her dignity to consider. She pushed her engine speed well past its theoretical limits, and the whole structure of the sled shook and shuddered beneath her. The engine was making really unpleasant sounds now, and threatening to get nasty.
Come on, baby, you can do this!
She'd done a lot of work on the sled. It would hold together. It would have to.
Think, damn it, think! There has to be a way!
The answer came to her in a flash. It was a crazy, dangerous answer, and if anyone else had suggested it, she would have probably shot them outright, but she sent the sled shooting up into the sky again. She shut down all her force shields, feeding the extra power to the engine. Behind her, the ecstatic had buried his face in the small of her back so he wouldn't have to see what they were doing. Emma didn't blame him. The gravity barge loomed up before her, filling the sky and growing ever more massive by the moment. She shot up past its nose, missing the prow by barely a yard or so, and kept on going. Emma pulled the sled over in a great loop, till they were actually flying upside down, held in place only by the sled's emergency crash webbing. The blood poured out of Emma's head and rushed towards her boots, but she was damned if she'd faint. She kept the sled speeding through its great loop, powered on by its straining engine, until, so suddenly it took her breath away, they came dropping down out of the loop, right way up again, and closing in fast on the rear of the gravity barge. Heading, in fact, straight for the exposed rear vents of its engines, the one place not protected by force shields, so the engine's energies could dissipate safely. Bit of a design fault, really. Emma opened up with every disruptor she had. The barge tilted slowly over onto one side as fuel cell after fuel cell shut down rather than add to the explosions, and the gravity barge began its slow, implacable descent towards the ground below.
Woo-hoo!
Emma turned her sled around and headed once more towards New Hope.
And people say I'm crazy.
No one else tried to stop them. New Hope was a city in the clouds, a great metropolis 20 miles in diameter, floating high in the sky, serene and untroubled by the woes of the mundane world below, protected by terrible unseen powers, greater than armies and more destructive. No one troubled the Oversoul. The great city blazed with lights, vivid and brilliant against the early evening sky, supernaturally beautiful. A fairy kingdom of gossamer glass and steel. Delicate structures of grace and charm, linked by high walkways, every building a work of art. New Hope, almost too beautiful a city for human eyes. Emma Steele slowed her sled's approach, allowing her to study the city from what she hoped was still a safe distance.
Are you sure you want to do this? This is an exclusively Esper city. Humans aren't welcome, mostly.
It is a risk. Hopefully the Espers will see me as being sufficiently different from baseline humanity to accept my temporary presence. New Hope has always been a place of sanctuary for those who are gifted and in need. I think when they see what's in my head, what I know, and the things that I have seen of yesterday and tomorrow, they'll want me to stay. Certainly the Oversoul is one of the few forces in the Empire powerful enough to protect me from everything the Angel will be sending after me.
The Angel? You mean Angelo Bellini, the Angel of Madraguda? He's the one who put the death mark on you? What the hell have you got on him? Bit footage of him prancing about in woman's underwear at an Hellfire Club dinner dance?
Nothing so amusing. If the Espers won't take me, I suppose there's always the clones. But they don't have New Hope's formidable defenses. And their dress sense is appalling.
You know, you're sounding very rational all of a sudden.
I find stark terror concentrates the mind wonderfully. Don't worry, it won't last.
The city grew before them as they approached cautiously, keeping to a clearly non-threatening speed. The hairs on the back of Emma's neck stirred, anticipating the psionic assault she probably wouldn't even have time to feel. The Esper should have more sense than to attack the authority a Paragon represented, but she was most definitely where she shouldn't be, and after the Neumann riot, everyone was on edge and looking for trouble. The sled crossed the city perimeter and headed steadily towards the official landing pads, and Emma let out a breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding. If the Espers were going to stop her, they would have done it by now. Unless the Oversoul was planning something really unpleasant to make an example of her and her companion. The city unfolded constantly before them, like a glorious flower. New Hope had a strong, almost overwhelming sense of presence, as though it were more real, more there, than anywhere else in the material world. It glowed fiercely, as though illuminated from within by its own vitality. Emma found that disturbing. She knew that New Hope had no generators, no reactors, no artificial power sources of any kind. The city, all of it, was powered and maintained and levitated by the Espers themselves. The Oversoul was a living power source, generated from living minds, and thus utterly independent from the rest of Logris, and indeed the rest of the Empire. Emma steered her sled carefully between the elegant towers soaring up all around her, impossibly high, wonderfully crafted from glass and steel and precious metals. Every structure was a thing of beauty and a joy to behold. People flew in and out of the buildings, soaring gracefully through the air without the need for cumbersome technology. Down on the streets, people appeared and disappeared, came and went, teleporting in and out in the blink of an eye. And everywhere, men and women looked at objects which moved or disappeared or burst into flames. No machines, no tech, anywhere in New Hope. They weren't needed. New Hope had moved beyond reliance upon such things. Emma Steele brought her sled down to rest on the edge of the city's landing pads, and only then paused to wonder how she'd been able to find her way there. She'd never been in New Hope before. Someone had placed the information in her mind. She shuddered despite herself, then stepped down from the sled and made a point of glaring about her. She was a Paragon, dammit, and entitled to a proper and respectful reception. She was also an entirely unwanted guest, so she stayed where she was. Dignity was one thing. Arrogance would only get her killed, or worse. The Oversoul guarded its secrets jealously. That was, after all, why she'd brought the ecstatic here. Even the Angel of Madraguda couldn't afford to get the Oversoul mad at him. Emma folded her arms across her breastplate and tapped her foot impatiently as she looked about her. There was no one else on the landing pads. No ships, no travelers, not even any signs of customs and excise. Emma considered the implications of that for a moment, and then decided not to. It was only upsetting her. She turned around to help Joy down from the sled, and when she turned back, an Esper was standing right in front of her. Emma refused to jump, but it still took a moment for her heart to settle. The Esper was a tall woman, almost supernaturally thin, with a long, bony face and long, blonde flyaway hair, framing her head like a halo. She inclined her head slightly to the ecstatic, in something that was almost a bow, but not quite, and then looked coldly at Emma with dark, dark eyes. Emma glared right back at her, and then felt as much as heard, a buzzing in her head, like an itch she couldn't scratch, somewhere behind her eyes. It grew suddenly worse, a pain stabbing outwards from the center of her brain. She swayed unsteadily on her feet and put a hand to her head. And then her mind opened up. Blossoming like a flower in the rain, spreading wide in all directions, some of which she had never even supposed existed before. Sight and sound and colors and echoes and so much more. And for a moment, Emma Steele caught just a glimpse of the Oversoul at work, an intricate lattice of interconnecting thoughts, communicating with more speed and clarity and depth than mere speech could ever allow. A million minds all talking at once, without anything being lost or drowned out, forming patterns of logic and structures of emotion, unbearably beautiful, inhumanly complex, infinitely productive, the Oversoul. And then the pain crashed back into Emma's head as her mind slammed shut, her glimpse of heaven over, the gates slammed shut in her face.
Huh?
Emma looked at the Esper before her with new eyes.
Why did you show me that? And why did you shut me out again?
You have the Esper gene, Paragon. It's buried deep in your ancestry. Not strong enough to maintain telepathy without extensive support. Continuing the contact would have burned you out permanently. You don't belong here. Though your descendants might someday. We are humanity's future, after all. One day we shall all shine like suns. The Owen said so.
You're starting to sound like him. He's an ecstatic.
Yes, I recognized the smile.
She looked at Joy, frowned briefly, and something passed between them. The Esper nodded reluctantly.
Very well. He shall have sanctuary. You must leave, Paragon.
Just like that?
Emma let her hands rest ostentatiously on her weapons belt and gave the Esper her best scowl.
Blow that out of your ears! This is Paragon business. I'm not budging from here till I get answers. Why is the church suddenly killing ecstatics? What does this one know that's so damned important? And why are you willing to protect him?
Things are changing. The church needs enemies to keep its members focused. Give the people someone to hate, and they'll stop thinking for themselves. Make them hate enough, and they'll turn on anyone. You should know that, Paragon. Soon the church will turn on Espers. We are the next logical target. We're too sane to fall for the church's lies and temptations, and too powerful and too dangerous to be allowed to exist outside the church. They'll come for us next. We are calling all our people home, back to the security of New Hope. We will not fall again. You must go now.
Hold on just a minute, who do you think you are?
The next thing she knew, she was standing beside her gravity sled on the landing pads of Logris's main starport, right back where she'd first arrived on the planet. She'd been teleported. There was no sign of the ecstatic.
Bloody hell.
Emma shrugged and stepped back up onto her sled. She rose slowly back into the sky and floated back across the city, going nowhere in particular. The Parade of the Endless seemed very different now from when she'd first arrived, such a short time ago. So full of happiness and good intentions then, even innocent. Though that was not a word she would have used about herself before she came to Logris. But now her whole world had changed, and perhaps the Empire too. Humanity was becoming something new, something darker. Sometimes it seemed to Emma that the only thing that hadn't changed for the worse was her. She still believed in what it meant to be a Paragon. She soared slowly over the city, and down in the streets below, people looked up at her, and didn't wave or cheer or smile. She was no longer their protector. She was the enemy. Emma Steele frowned, and wondered almost helplessly what to do next. Anne Barclay sat alone in her office, swiveling back and forth in her familiar old chair, watching her display of monitor screens with the sound turned down. She glanced from screen to screen but saw nothing. None of it mattered, not really. The House would be going into session soon, and there were all kinds of urgent matters that ought to be commanding her attention, but she couldn't seem to concentrate on any of them. She had a mug of hot, sweet black coffee in her hand, and she sipped at it now and again, when she remembered it was there, but she didn't really taste it. Her other hand moved slowly over her close-cropped red hair, an old familiar caress that for once failed to comfort. Anne was feeling unappreciated. She worked all the hours God sent, practically ran the house's security single-handed these days, and no one cared. She always made sure Douglas had every bit of information he needed, often hours before anyone else had it, and she couldn't remember the last time he said thank you. She rushed from room to room and meeting to meeting, making the secret necessary deals that Douglas couldn't be seen to make himself, and all for what? Despite all her hard work, despite all the miracles she worked every day on Douglas's behalf, he just took her for granted. He didn't even talk with her anymore. Oh, he'd pop in to make sure she knew all about his latest problems and orders, sometimes throw her a brief, meaningless smile, and then he was off and on his way again. He never paused to say, "Well done," or "Couldn't do it without you," or even, "You're my good right hand, Anne. I'm so proud of you." Not much to ask for, really. She knew he was busy. She knew he worked even longer hours than she did. She knew she was being unfair. And she didn't give a damn. She'd never felt so alone, so desolate, so miserable. Jessamine was always too busy, or perhaps too guilty, to talk with her anymore. Aunt Lewis was unofficially but very definitely in disgrace, and only allowed into the house on special occasions. Anne drank more coffee she didn't want. She couldn't go to see Lewis without risking seeming disloyal to Douglas, and the king had been hurt enough. All of which meant there was no one left for Anne to talk to, or at least no one she could trust. So she came to the office early and left late, and worked till she was numb, because that was all she had left. Bringing the house and its security under her control, because she couldn't control her own life. She looked almost reluctantly at the lowest drawer of her desk, securely locked and sealed, where she kept the bright pink feather boa Jessamine had given her. She should have thrown it away, given it to someone who could appreciate it, or at the very least was brave enough to wear it in public. But somehow, she couldn't bring herself to do that. The boa was important to her. It represented something valuable, though she wasn't sure what. Freedom, perhaps. The freedom to be someone other than boring, old, dependable Anne Barkley. Someone who had the guts to go and find a life of her own. Someone who knew how to have fun. To do all the things Anne Barkley dreamed of, but had never found the time or the courage to go looking for. Someone who knew how to live, instead of just exist. There was a single mirror on her desk, small, plain, and functional. Nothing at all of vanity about it. Anne looked at her own face in the mirror and didn't recognize it. That wasn't her, that grim, scowling mask with hollow, desperate eyes. That old, dead woman.
You don't know what I want. None of you know what I want, what I need. I want to go dancing, wear something scandalous in the kind of sleazy cheap joint where people like Anne Barkley don't belong. I want to drink too much, make an exhibition of myself, pull some good-looking boy off the dance floor and into the toilets and have rough, loveless sex with him. I want to do things I'll be ashamed of in the morning. I want to do everything I'm not supposed to do, everything I was never allowed to do. I want to be like Jess and Lewis and never give a damn. Oh God, I want to feel alive before it's too late.
She flushed guiltily, swiveled her chair around, and regarded the closed door suspiciously. She wasn't expecting any visitors, and her staff knew better than to bother her when she said she had some thinking to do. She glanced back over her shoulder at the monitor screen that covered the corridor outside. Standing patiently outside her door was the honorable member for Viramont, Michel Dubois. Anne raised an eyebrow. It had been a long time since Dubois had wanted anything from her, mainly because he knew he wouldn't get it. The best memories Anne had of Viramond were of leaving it. Provincial bloody dump. They'd never appreciated her either.
Come in.
At least it was someone to talk to, and she was curious. Michel Dubois entered with his usual practiced dignity, dressed in his very best for the upcoming day's session. He bowed low to Anne before pulling up a chair and sitting down opposite her without asking permission first. He smiled at Anne. She didn't smile back. He'd only take it as a sign of weakness. Whatever it was he wanted, it had to be something he couldn't get anywhere else. Dubois arranged his formal robes fussily and met Anne's gaze with something very like sincerity.
Viramond has chosen a new paragon. A highly proficient young man with excellent prospects, called Stuart Lennox. Comes from a good family, has a fine record as one of Viramond's peacekeepers, and not a trace of scandal anywhere about him. A bit glum and humorless, perhaps, and he'll need some coaching before we can turn him loose in front of the media, but he's solid, dependable, and a canny fighter. Just what we need to represent our homeworld before the Empire. He'll arrive here for his investiture somewhere next week, just in time for the royal wedding.
Why are you telling me? I don't work with paragons.
Viramond is your home world. I thought you'd be interested, particularly since of late you've become somewhat distanced from the previous paragon.
Ah, so that's it. It always comes down to Lewis in the end, blast his soul. What have you heard, Dubois? What do you think you know? And what makes you think I might give a damn what you might or might not know?
Dubois spread his arms wide in an expansive gesture and tried to look innocent. He wasn't especially successful. He was a politician, after all.
It's clear to everyone, inside and outside the house, that you and the Deathstalker are no longer as close as you once were. And since the king has also been taking some pains to publicly distance himself from his champion of late, it doesn't take a genius to work out that something significant must have happened. Lewis has made many mistakes of judgment since becoming champion, separating himself from his friends, and those who would be his friends, disgracing himself through his actions during the Neumann riot. Most important, failing to be the champion everyone wanted. The Deathstalker is no longer a credit to our homeworld.
Is that why you cut off his stipend?
He was no longer entitled to those monies. The allowance will go to Stuart Lennox, who will no doubt be much more appreciative. Don't mistake me, Anne. It pains me to see the Deathstalker brought so low. It really does. But he brought it upon himself by his own actions.
I'm busy. What do you want from me, Dubois?
It occurred to me that you, as one of the Deathstalker's oldest and closest friends, might be able to shed some light on why dear Lewis has been acting so out of character just lately.
He's just going through a bad time. We all do.
But if you knew something private, something personal...
I'd have more sense than to discuss it with you. Stay away from Lewis, Dubois. That's my advice to you. Stick to pulling your new paragon's strings. You try to push Lewis around, even in his present state, and he'll eat you alive. Now, if that's all, I have work to do.
Michel Dubois rose gracefully to his feet, his expression professionally neutral, untouched by Anne's harsh words.
I can see this isn't the right time to discuss these matters. Your support for your friend does you credit, Anne. It really does. But I feel I would be failing in my duty as your homeworld's representative if I didn't warn you of the dangers involved if you persist in this attitude.
Anne leaned back in her chair and smiled nastily. She was always happiest when the threat came out into the open.
Dangers, Dubois? Why? Whatever can you mean? I'm not aware of any dangers.
Lewis is on his way out. He's going to fall, and he's going to fall fast. Anyone can see that. It would be such a shame if he was to bring his friends down with him. Especially when all they had to do was reach out and take the hand of a new friend.
You never had a friend in your life, Dubois.
Perhaps. But I have always understood the value of an ally. There was a time when you would have too.
Michel Dubois left while Anne was still trying to come up with an answer to that one. Anne scowled fiercely and swiveled her chair angrily back and forth. For all her justified dislike of the man, she had to admit that his words had seemed more like a warning than a threat. But why would he care? They'd never been close, personally or politically.
Perhaps he just thought that having two highly placed and very visible natives of Viramond brought low would reflect badly on his world. Whatever else she could say about him, and Anne had said a lot in her time, Dubois had always been a patriot. Anne decided she'd better take a serious look at the new Paragon's background, see if there was anything there she ought to know about. Some days people just wouldn't let her brood in peace. She checked the hall monitor screen again, and there was Jessamine Flowers, looking very beautiful and almost unbearably glamorous, holding a large box tied up with pink ribbon. Anne studied the screen for a long moment. Beware queens-to-be bearing gifts, especially when they've been caught red-handed betraying their husbands-to-be. Anne composed herself.
Come in.
Jessamine pushed the present into Anne's arms, kissed the air near her cheeks, and threw herself into the chair Dubois had just vacated, all without once hesitating, betraying any awkwardness or pausing for breath. Jessamine had always known how to make an entrance.
Well, open the box, darling. It's just a little prezi to smooth the way between us. You're going to simply adore it. Go on, open it, sweetie. It won't bite.
Anne undid the large, floppy pink bow and carefully put the length of pink ribbon to one side. She collected things like that. She never knew when they might come in useful. She opened the long box, dropping the lid on the floor beside her chair, and there in the box was a gorgeous gown of shimmering silver. Perhaps the most beautiful dress Anne had ever seen. Glamorous, stylish, a product of the very best designer label, and undoubtedly worth more than Anne made in a year. A dress to make any woman look like a queen. And nothing Anne would ever wear, would ever dare to wear. Anne's fingers trailed lovingly over the sheer, marvelous material, almost in spite of herself. It felt like a kiss on her fingertips. It was, without a doubt, the finest dress Anne had ever known. And she wanted nothing more than to screw it up into a ball and throw it back in Jessamine's face. To scream at her in rage and shame for not knowing Anne would never, ever be able to wear a thing like this.
I came across this in my wardrobe and thought of you immediately. It's one of my favorite gowns from when I was playing Kate in Taming of the Shrew. It's always brought me good luck, and I'm sure it will do the same for you.
Well, it's been a while since I was offered hand-me-downs. What next, Jess? Some old pair of shoes with the heels hardly worn down, or maybe half a box of chocolates you couldn't be bothered to finish.
Why are you being like this, Anne? I came here to kiss and make up. I want us to be friends again.
Why am I being like this? It has to be my fault, doesn't it? Never yours. Are you really that blind? That self-obsessed? You jeopardize the royal wedding, betray Douglas, and infatuate Lewis. And you wonder why I'm being like this? Grow up, Jess. This isn't some backstage romance, some brief fling for the gossip magazines to Twitter over. This is treason, Jess. I should never have put your name forward in the first place. I should have known you'd screw it up.
Look, I said I was sorry. I said it wouldn't happen again. What more do you want me to do?
I want you to be loyal to Douglas. I want you to act like a queen-in-waiting, not some stuck-up tart with an itch in her panties. I want you to leave Lewis alone. It's not like he means anything to you. I know you, Jess.
No, you don't. You don't know me at all. Lewis is special.
Yes, yes, he is. He deserves better than you. He doesn't understand. This is all a game to you. I don't want him hurt. So stay away from him. He doesn't need you in his life.
He needs someone.
He needs someone who'll care for him. Someone who'll care about him. Not just use him because he's there, then throw him aside like a snotty tissue. Like you've done with so many others before him.
That's not fair. It wasn't like that. Lewis is different.
That's right. Lewis is different from you and me. He knows the meaning of duty and of honor. Or at least he used to before he met you. If you have any feelings for him at all, leave him alone! Before you destroy him completely, he's a good man. You're not worthy of him.
Oh. Oh. Jessamine erupted out of her chair, her cheeks blazing, vicious, unforgivable words trembling on her lips. Words that could never be taken back or apologized for. Words that would mean the end of her oldest friendship. She stood there, breathing heavily for a moment, and somehow choked the words down. But she had nothing else to say, so she turned and stormed out of Anne's office, away from her accusing eyes. And there in the corridor, heading straight for her, was Lewis Deathstalker. Part of her wanted to turn and run, but she didn't. Jessamine stood her ground as Lewis walked up to her and stopped right in front of her. She was breathing hard, her heart hammering in her breast. Their eyes met, and all their good intentions went for nothing. They'd kept apart from each other, each hoping the madness would pass, but it hadn't. All it took was the sight of each other, and their hearts raced. Deny it all they could, they were meant to be together. And neither king nor parliament, duty nor honor, could keep them apart.
What are you doing here, Lewis?
Came to see Anne. Looking for something to do. Someone to talk to. How have you been, Jess? You look good.
Fine. I've been fine. You look good, too.
No, I don't. I'm famous for not looking good.
You look good to me.
He's my friend, Jess.
I know.
And suddenly, they were kissing again. Bodies pressed tight together, as though trying to become one person that could never be parted. While in her lonely office, Anne watched them kiss on her monitor screen, her clenched hands full of the material of the marvelous dress. King Douglas sat stiffly on his great throne in the House of Parliament, nodding graciously to the various honorable members as they assembled to take their seats. There weren't as many as usual, or even as many as he'd hoped for. Attendance was well down on what he'd expected. Most hadn't even bothered to attend by hollow. Probably they were scared the House was going to have to discuss the problem of pure humanity and the church militant soon. But none of the honorable members wanted to commit themselves publicly to one position or another until they absolutely had to. Public opinion was vacillating wildly, and their representatives were running scared. Douglas sat on his throne and felt very exposed, very alone. He wished Jessamine was at his side. He wondered briefly what was keeping her. It couldn't be anything important, or Anne would have briefed him by now over his private comm channel. He shifted uncomfortably. He didn't want to be here, didn't want to be doing this, presiding over a session that no one cared about, when so many things were going wrong, in the city, all over Logris, all across the Empire. The influence of the church militant was spreading like a disease, infecting world after world. The gospel of pure humanity was taking hold on planets he would have sworn had more sense, or at least more decency. And now there were scattered reports coming in of Neumann fanatics killing ecstatics in the streets. The most harmless creatures in the Empire, being hunted down like animals. The Paragon in Douglas seethed within him, demanding he go out into the city and do something. Something to stop the madness.
Oh, Father. You tried to warn me. The throne is a trap, you said. A duty without end, a responsibility without comfort. A weight that crushes, born because somebody has to do it. But Father, you never told me how alone I'd feel. Jessamine, where are you?
Finally, the house reached a point where everybody who was coming was there, and the session at last got underway. No one mentioned the missing champion or Jessamine, just as no one mentioned Douglas threatening to give up his crown during the Neumann riot. He was back on the throne wearing the crown, so no one said anything. Everyone just pretended it had never happened. The House could be very good at that when it chose. The day's business passed smoothly enough, with little need for Douglas to intervene, until finally he got the chance to raise the one matter he really cared about. His own plan to snatch a little sanity back from the ever-increasing madness.
I propose a great parade of paragons through the city. Since most of the Empire's paragons are still assembled in this city awaiting the royal wedding, let's take this opportunity to fete them as they deserve, to celebrate their achievements as heroes of the Empire. Finn Durandal came up with the idea originally and presented it to me, and I think it's a good one. It gives us a chance to re-establish the popularity of the Paragons and their authority. Show the city and Logris and the Empire that this house and this crown still stand 100% behind the Paragons. The media will love it. Prime time coverage guaranteed. With a little encouragement from the right quarters, I'm sure the news channels could be persuaded to build up to the event by showing lots of programming, covering the Paragons' past triumphs and victories. Remind the people of just how much the Paragons have done for them in the past, how much they owe them. That will bring the crowds out onto the streets to cheer their heroes and provide news coverage that can be shown to all the worlds in the Empire. How say you, honorable members?
The honorable members loved it, mostly. Some fairly open supporters of pure humanity still wanted to investigate and even prosecute individual Paragons for their actions during the Neumann riot, very definitely including the Deathstalker, but they were quickly shouted down. The house wanted its heroes back, wanted to feel safe again, behind the protection of the Paragons. And they all understood the appeal of a good parade. Good publicity and good feeling from the parade would spill over onto the house, too. The king's proposal was accepted and passed by a huge majority. They then spent the rest of the session arguing fiercely over who was going to pay for it. Louis and Jessamine lay naked together, wrapped around each other, on the mattress on the floor of Louis's mostly empty bedroom. They smiled at each other, basking in the afterglow of a very happy time, the sweat still cooling and evaporating on their bodies. Nothing like delaying and denying sex to make it really frantic. It had to be Louis's place. They couldn't afford to be seen going to Jessamine's place together, and there wasn't a hotel in the city that wouldn't be straight on the comp to the gossip rags. So, Jessamine's own security people ran static, including the use of Jessamine's official double to distract and lure away the media pack that followed Jessamine wherever she went. Given how smoothly the whole operation went, Louis had a strong feeling they'd done this many times before, but he said nothing. The two of them sneaked successfully into Louis's apartment entirely unobserved, Jessamine carrying an S-blocker in her purse so there was no way they could be eavesdropped on. She wasn't taking any chances. Louis was impressed by her thoroughness. They went straight to the bedroom and stayed there. Finally, they sat up together, their backs pressed against the bare bedroom wall, still naked, eating death by chocolate ice cream straight from the same tub, with two spoons. Louis remembered to wash both the spoons first at the last moment. Every now and again, they'd flick some of the ice cream at each other and squeal and laugh and tussle playfully. Louis had never been happier. But even so,
we can't stay here much longer. The day's session in the house must have started by now. You have to be there, and I really ought to be. Can't have the house thinking there's a divide between the king and his queen-to-be. They'd be sure to try and take advantage. And I ought to be there for this session, because Douglas is going to put forward his proposal for a parade of Paragons through the city. I'm supposed to lead it.
And so you should. Douglas told me about it. Good idea. Excellent theatre. Just what the Paragons need. And the city come to that. Everyone loves a parade.
Surprisingly enough, it was Finn's idea originally. Took it to the king in person, with most of the details already worked out. Chose the best route and everything. Good to see him getting involved in things again. He's far too valuable to be wasted in an extended sulk. Perhaps having a new partner in Emma Steele is bringing him out of himself again.
Ah, the infamous Emma Steele. Possibly the only woman in the Empire almost as famous as I am. What's she really like?
Impressive. Even intimidating. Good at her job. And doesn't suffer fools gladly. Just what the city needs.
Everyone should get what they need.
Lewis put aside the ice cream tub and cuddled her to him. They leaned happily together, not feeling the need to do anything or go anywhere just yet. They felt comfortable, at ease, relaxed, in a way they never were as champion and queen-to-be. Jessamine looked around the bare and empty bedroom.
Darling, I have to say, this is a bit minimalist even for you. No vid screen, no furniture, no carpet, not even a bidet or a chair to pile your clothes on. I hate to think of you living like this. It's not right. Not for the champion of the Empire.
Ah, it's only temporary. Things will sort themselves out, you'll see. And then I'll get the best chair money can buy.
I wish I had your faith, dear.
Do you feel guilty?
Of course I do. I'm not entirely unfeeling, sweetie. I'm very fond of Douglas. I don't want to see him hurt.
Neither do I. He was always my closest friend. Ever since I came to Logris, he was always right there with me, backing me up. All the times we went into combat together, fighting side by side or back to back, trusting each other implicitly. I never thought I'd fail in my duty to him, as a king and a friend.
Jessamine took his chin in her hand and turned his face to hers.
Are you sorry, Lewis? Sorry about this, about us?
No. No. I know this is wrong, but I don't care. How can something that makes us both so happy be wrong?
That sounds like something I would say, darling. I've always been able to find really good excuses for my little picadillos.
Lewis considered that.
I won't ask.
Best not to, dear. You're different. I care about you.
Where do we go from here, Jess? What do we do about this?
Damned if I know, Lewis.
Should we tell Douglas?
I can't see any way where that would turn out for the best, sweetie. He loves me, you see.
Oh, Jesus. Do you love him?
No. I admire him. I'm fond of him. But that's all. Oh, Lewis, I waited so long for my first real love. I should have known it would be complicated. People like us aren't allowed to have normal, everyday lives.
Lewis sat bolt upright on the mattress, almost shoving Jessamine away from him so he could concentrate.
Lewis! Where the hell are you?
I'm at my apartment, Douglas, having a bit of a lie-down. What's up?
Get to Parliament fast. The shit has hit the fan and we're all in deep trouble. Can't brief you now, not even on a secure channel like this. Just get here as fast as you can.
On my way, Douglas.
Lewis swung his legs off the mattress and rose quickly to his feet. He was scowling hard, his ugly face so harsh now it actually frightened Jessamine for a moment. Lewis grabbed Jessamine's discarded clothing and threw it at her, and then climbed quickly into his black leather champion's armor. Jessamine clutched the dress to her chest and looked at Lewis almost timidly.
What is it, Lewis? What's wrong?
Get dressed. That was my emergency line. Something's happened. Something really bad by the sound of it. I have to get to the house. You'd better too.
Jessamine responded to the urgency in his voice and started putting her clothes on. Lewis was dressed and ready to go long before she was and strode impatiently around the room as he waited for her to finish. His mind was reeling with appalling possibilities. Everything from open Neumann insurrection to an outbreak of plague. When another, far more disturbing thought hit him. He stopped his pacing abruptly and looked across at Jessamine.
This couldn't be about us, could it, Jess? I mean, there's no way he could know about what just happened here. We were so careful.
Jessamine shrugged, studying her reflection critically in the bedroom's only mirror while trying to do something with her tousled hair.
He's the king. Who's to say what he can and can't know? I only have hardened security professionals. He has Anne. But I don't think this is about us, Lewis. He wouldn't want a public scandal, if only for his pride's sake. Look, go into the other room and try the news channels. See if they're showing anything yet.
I haven't got a vid screen.
What? Not at all? All right, that settles it. Next time we're going to my place and to hell with the difficulties. I absolutely refuse to live without the little necessities of life. There are limits, darling.
So there is going to be a next time?
Jessamine shook her head, exasperated, marched over to Lewis, and kissed him soundly on the mouth.
Lewis, that once I'd had you, once I'd ticked you off my list, I wouldn't want you anymore. We are in this for the long term, Lewis. Get used to it. Some things are just meant to be, sweetie.
Unfortunately, you and I seem to be the only ones in the whole damned empire who believe that. But we'll work something out. I know we will.
Of course we will, darling. Mwah.
Jessamine kissed him again, brushed briefly at his armored chest with her hand, and headed for the door. And then she paused and looked back over her shoulder at him.
Tell me, are you at all familiar with the plot of Macbeth?
Not funny, Jess.
Lewis shook his head as he went after her.
Not funny at all.
High up on a rooftop, Finn Durandal looked down on the street intersection and studied the public vidphone booth for some time from what he hoped was a safe distance. There were a lot of people about, coming and going and passing the phone booth without a second glance. It was situated right in the middle of a downtown shopping precinct on a not particularly busy corner, and it all looked innocent enough, but Finn still wasn't satisfied. You couldn't afford to take any chances when dealing with elves. They'd insisted on speaking to him directly before they'd agree to join him in his plot to destroy the Paragons, and since neither side was foolish enough to show up in person, that just left the usual means of communication, of which public vidphones were the most safely anonymous. Finn chose the setting, the elves chose the particular booth, and they both agreed on a time. Finn got there an hour early just in case, and watched from the rooftop, his force shield up, to protect him from sniper fire. All the sensors on his gravity sled insisted the booth hadn't been tampered with or booby-trapped in any way, but still Finn was suspicious. He had no doubt the elves would sacrifice the possible gains of his plan for the more satisfying pleasure of a definite strike against him. They would do anything to get their hands on the man who'd executed so many of them in the arena. Finn could understand that. He was all for revenge these days. But the agreed time finally arrived, and he couldn't see any good reason for hanging back any longer, and he didn't want the elves to think they could intimidate him, so he stepped onto his gravity sled and swooped down into the intersection below. People scattered to give him room. He ignored them all, stepped off his hovering sled, and entered the vidphone booth. They had been watching after all. Probably through some far-off thrall's possessed eyes. No point in looking around, it could be anyone. Finn hit the accept button, and the screen lit up before him to show a male face he didn't recognize at all. The vicious, arrogant smile and the wide, staring eyes were familiar, though.
Hello, Finn. I do so love a man who's punctual. How do you like this body? Just a little something I threw on, especially for you. So we could have this little talk.
Forget the pleasantries. We're allies against a common enemy, and that's all we're ever going to be. Let's get down to business.
Yes, let's. I want to hear you tell me all about how you're going to betray your fellow Paragons. I want to hear it from your own lips. See the truth of it in your eyes.
They're not my fellows anymore. I disown them. The plan is just as my people described it to you. By now, the king will have put to Parliament my proposal for a parade of Paragons, including the route details I so kindly worked out for him. Here's the map with all the particulars you'll need.
Finn fed his info card into the vidphone, and the elf thrall downloaded the information at his end.
You now have the entire route in advance, along with certain carefully worked out blind spots where you can conceal yourselves and wail. The Paragons won't be expecting a mass Esper onslaught. They'll be too busy acknowledging the cheers and applause of the crowd to even realize what's happening until it's far too late. All the Paragons in one spot, trapped in a shooting gallery, sitting ducks for determined elves with revenge on their mind. That's what I'm offering you. Real payback for what happened in the arena.
Well, your information is very thorough. It appears to be everything you say it is. But why should we attack the Paragons in person? Much safer to use thralls. Use the innocent possessed to do our dirty work for us, so that even if the Paragons do fight back, they'll have to kill innocents to protect themselves. That's the elf way.
Civilians with guns, even possessed civilians, won't stand a chance against masked paragons. They'll shoot your thralls down before you can achieve anything worthwhile. They'll hate themselves afterwards for doing it, but they'll do it. But if you're there in person, in great enough numbers, that much masked mental power will be able to punch right through the few S-blockers they'll have with them and possess the paragons themselves. You could make them kill each other. Your hands, once removed, doing the bloody business. So much more satisfying, yes? Revenge should always be personal. But understand, this is the only chance I can give you. Be a shame if you threw it away, just because you didn't have the balls to turn up in person.
You will see what the elves can do. We will show you atrocities and nightmares never to be forgotten. We will do such things to the paragons that when we finally let them die and go to hell, the fires of the pit will be a comfort to them.
That's what I want.
And when we're done with them, and they're all dead, we'll come for you, Finn Durandal, the last paragon.
No.
Finn was smiling for the first time.
Then I'll come for you.
You have no idea who we are and where we are. And you never will, because we never leave loose ends.
He held his hand up beside his face. It held a long knife with a serrated edge. The elf made the thrall, cut out his eyes, cut off his nose, and licked the blood off the blade. And then he cut his throat. Blood gushed out, spattering the vidphone camera lens. Finn watched, unmoved, as the elf withdrew from the thrall's mind, leaving an innocent man to die a horrified, senseless death. He fell back out of camera range, and Finn shut down the link from his end. About what he'd expected from the elves. They'd always had a taste for the grand gesture. Finn left the booth, stepped onto his waiting sled, and soared quickly up into the sky. He looked sharply about him for some sign of an ambush, but all seemed calm and quiet. Finn flew on over the city, frowning thoughtfully. Dealing with elves, even at arm's length, was always going to be dangerous. But so far, his plan seemed to be working out perfectly. And, thanks to Brett and Rose, he at least knew where two of the elves were, even though Brett was still in shock from his encounter with the spider harps. Finn smiled happily. No, he was still ahead of the game, while everyone else only thought they were. He would have his revenge on his enemies and put himself one step closer to his eventual goal. And if things were progressing only slowly, well, what's the point of revenge if you don't take the time to savor it? Louis Deathstalker and Jessamine Flowers arrived at the house, carefully separately, to find the whole place in an uproar. The narrow corridors and offices backstage were a complete bedlam, with people running back and forth, plunging in and out of rooms with white faces and wild, staring eyes, shouting incoherently at each other. In overcrowded offices, people sat and stood over computer terminals, trying desperately to get information out of them. And some just stood in doorways or sat on the floor in the corridors, sobbing helplessly with their hands pressed to their faces. Louis hurried through the corridors, a growing premonition chilling his heart till he could hardly breathe. What had happened while he was away, out of the loop, selfishly enjoying himself? What could have happened to cause such panic and despair? He started grabbing people and shouting questions at them, but they just tore themselves away. No one had the time to talk to him, and not even his champion's authority or Deathstalker face was enough to slow them down. Louis saw Jessamine slipping through the great door onto the floor of the house and decided he'd better give her a few minutes' start. Even now, in the midst of all this, he had to be careful. Had to protect his reputation and Douglas's. Besides, There was still one place he could go where he would be sure to get answers and information. One person who always knew what was going on. In fact, he should have gone there first. He headed for Ann Barkley's office, and when he got there, the door opened before he could even knock. Inside, he found Ann sitting slumped in her chair, not even looking at her monitor screens. She turned the sound off, so her screens were full of tiny people shouting dumbly at each other. She looked stunned, as though someone had hit her. She was trying to drink coffee from her favorite mug, but her hand was shaking too much. She tried using both hands, but it didn't help much. She looked dully at Lewis as he moved over to her, and didn't smile or even nod.
What is it? What the hell has happened? Is Douglas all right? Has there been another suicide bomber?
Anne looked at him with cold, bitter eyes, her mouth a flat line.
You should have been here, Lewis. You should have been here.
Tell Douglas that. He's the one who told me to stay away. No, talk to me, Anne. What's happened?
You think I don't know where you've been? What you've been doing? I know. I can smell her on you.
Lewis stopped short, as though she'd hit him.
Anne.
Shut up, Lewis. Go into the house. Be with your king. He needs you. Jess doesn't matter now. Nothing else matters now.
Anne, what?
The terror, Lewis. The terror has finally arrived.
Lewis gaped at her, horror flooding through him as he finally understood.
Dear God.
He backed away from her and then turned and ran from the room, heading for the house and his king. In fulfillment of Owen Deathstalker's warning of 200 years earlier, a nightmarish alien entity has intruded into human space and shrugs off any defense humanity hurls against it. King Douglas and Parliament grapple over what can be done, fixing on a desperate plan, a quest that will engage most of the paragons of the Empire. In preparation for this vital mission, Lewis Deathstalker consults with the artificial intelligences of Shub, who have some disturbing revelations for the King's champion. And the time and place chosen to announce the great quest to the public will be the eagerly anticipated parade of paragons, coincidentally the scene of treacherous Finn Girondal's prearranged Esper attack. Deathstalker Legacy, Episode 5, Terror in the Night. Deathstalker Legacy, Questionable Choices is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2002, Simon R. Green. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Vanessa Benjamin, Sonny Lasky, Corey James, Colleen Delaney, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Michael Replogle, Karen Carbone, Nathaniel Perry, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Brian Rogers and Chris Rowan. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Dan Smith. The Deathstalker Legacy theme was composed by Dan Smith. Additional original music by Dan Smith. Check out the bonus disc for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator.